No.
Okay, let's welcome everybody on the way over here. Good morning, everybody. Today, we will again completely change gears in this workshop. We had 1 week of biology only, then we had 10 days of sequence alignment, which we sort of turned into physics by interpreting this sequence alignment algorithm as a dynamic equation describing a physical system. Today we will then now do something which I guess any physicist would agree that it's real physics. We'll look at actual physical interactions and how they play a role in DNA and RNA and in the function of those molecules in the cell. What I'll do this morning is I will give a very elementary tutorial on what DNA and RNA structure is about. So I hope that I don't bore anybody, but I really try to start at the very beginning to get everybody on the same level. At the very end, I will then show you how the things which I introduced here will then be treated, the different aspects of that in different talks throughout the next 10 days and also throughout the rest of the workshop. Let's start with DNA, and let's start from the most macroscopic scale we can look at DNA. And there we notice that DNA is a heteropolymer, meaning basically a long and thin thing made up of different types of monomers. And DNA is really, if you look at this, the best polymer molecule which polymer physicists could have, because it comes in a very wide range of lengths from a lambda phage, which has only 50,000 monomer, and that's 17 microns long, over E. coli, so typical bacterial genome, which is about a millimeter long, and to humans, where we have a DNA which is 1 meter long, up to even longer things, like the lily, for example, which has a 30-meter DNA. Well, that's putting all the chromosomes together, but nevertheless, you figure, I mean, this is really what a polymer physicist thinks the polymer should be. It's a very, very long and very, very thin object. If you put such a polymer into a solution, it will basically, on large enough length scales, and I mean, these things are certainly long enough for that to be true, go into a Gaussian random walk, or more precisely, probably a self-avoided random walk. And this is basically specified by two numbers, one of them being the radius of gyration, which you can think of as being just the size of the random coil that you get. And for a human, this radius of gyration of DNA is of the order of a tenth of a millimeter. The other scale, which is important, is the persistence length. We have a persistence length for two reasons. Persistence length basically is the length over which the polymer forgets in which direction it's currently going. So the persistence length has something to do with the bending rigidity. One of the main reasons is that DNA is negatively charged. So in principle, every monomer of the backbone can contribute one charge. Also, just the internal structure of DNA.
What's the length of the monomer?
The length of a monomer is about 7 angstroms. We'll come to that. So
just to know how many monomers in a persistence length, in number of units, which is the LT unit.
Well, around 100, yeah. If it were a single strand, it would be 7 angstroms, but I mean, still in the order of 100. Okay.
Can I ask you,
sure.
You have this regular observation of gyration for a human, I suppose you could take a causal strip off all the borders, everything else, and just have the DNA. But can you actually do this experimentally without breaking anything?
I don't know.
Well, now the question is that there is this radius of gyration of 100 microns there.
Right.
For a
human.
So it's possible to, I'm just asking whether it's possible to have a complete, you know, the DNA of, the whole DNA of the chromosome, strip off all the proteins without it having, you know, without breaking, without damaging it, and you can actually have a dye solution like this.
I don't know if somebody tried that with human. I mean, it certainly, I mean, people have like lambda phage around.
Yeah, but that's not sure, so that's why I was asking whether it's possible.
I don't know.
I've seen photographs of unfolded DNA.
That was human? Or at least you've heard of it?
I think that was pretty big.
I don't know.
No, I suspect it would be difficult to actually do it without breaking. I don't know.
Yeah. But is this a, this is a theoretical value for radius of gyration given?
Yeah, I mean, that, it's
way.
Not from a chromosome. Okay, but I mean, the question obviously here is how does this thing fit into a cell, given that the cell nucleus is only of the order of like a micrometer? And I mean, we already heard the answer. I mean, the cell has to invent all sorts of mechanisms in order to wrap DNA around proteins and things like that to make it fit in there. Okay, if we look at it a little bit more closely, what we see is that DNA is this famous double helix usually. And with this double helix gives us sort of some internal structure. And I don't want to say too much about this slide. Basically, what follows from this internal structure is that if you, for example, take the ends of the DNA and start twisting it, and it will wrap up into these coiled things, which you know all from your telephone cord. And this is a whole area of physics which basically studies the mechanical properties of DNA without looking at anything like bases or anything like that. Just taking a long polymer with the additional helical structure in there, for example, Marco Insigia, most prominently, have gotten quite a lot of results on that. But that's something which we basically will not touch upon in this workshop at all. If we go a little further down in length, then we can actually see how this helical structure looks like. That is the structure of B-DNA, which is the most common form of DNA. And you see these two helices here. Things to remember is that the number of bases within one helix turn is around 10.5. And then also very important that you have, that this thing is not symmetric, you have two grooves in here, one of them being larger than the other, that is the major groove, and that is the minor groove. And that is important because you always have to think that eventually in the cell, proteins want to start interacting with this DNA and reading out sequence. And they have to do that by actually fitting into one of these grooves. Diameter is about 20 angstroms, and yeah, here we have these 3 angstroms, which is the height, and the 7 angstroms that would be just measuring along the backbone. There are two alternative structures of DNA. One is the A-DNA. One of the major differences is that the tilt of the base pairs, that's if the helix axis goes like that, how much they are tilted against it, is much larger than in B-DNA, and that also gives us a smaller pitch, so it's something that is shorter. And we have Z-DNA, which instead of A and B-DNA is a left-handed helix and has basically only one groove.
Well, the fact that the translational invariance is broken, they said this minor and that major group. Does this have to do with the 10.5 peak we've seen yesterday?
The translation?
I mean, you have a minor and a major group, so it's not.
I mean, it's not clear to me how that should actually show up. I mean, how does it have to show up?
And if you look at that sequence correlations, but I mean, definitely these 10.5 here is the repeat. I don't see how you say that this is, I mean, related to the major and minor group. I mean, you have also something which would be symmetric. I mean, it won't work for DNA, but in principle, you could imagine a symmetric DNA, I don't know, symmetric double helix with a pitch of 10.5. You know, I don't see how this is necessarily
connected. In general, how this sort of interacts with the composition.
Well, okay, I mean, you. And if stuff wants to bind on that, you can imagine that it can sort of feel if it comes from one side that there is a repeat of 10.5. But I mean that's the only thing I can think of how this would really influence. And I mean then evolution has to develop sequences which have the same sort of correlation. But I mean that's basically speculation.
If you have a double helix, how do you only have one groove? Is it just that the other groove is filled up, or?
Yeah, I mean, there is a bigger thing.
I have some thoughts about this 10.5 repeat. If you have a curvature of DNA, it's not very active, right? So, then you have some repeat of one basis, which, because different bases gives up a different bend. So if you have this, then you have this.
You mean a poly A or poly C or something?
No, not poly A. But if you have heterogeneous DNA,
but a particular sequence.
Yeah. But some sequences give DNA possibility to bend in one direction.
Those have to have a repeat of 10.5.
And this 10.5, I think, for short
DNA, now it is shown
for genome. Where can one look this up?
Paper. The key name is Zhurkin. Z-H-U-R-K-E-N. Oh, that's
First paper is a Russian journal, now it is in NA.
Okay, let's go even closer to this thing. And then you see that actually in this helix coming off the backbone, we have these four different bases, which are the two purines, which have this double rings and the two pyrimidines, which have the single rings. These are these famous letters A, G, T, and C. And what you can already obviously see, if you want to pair those and you want to keep a certain fixed distance between the two sides, obviously you always have to pair one single ring with one double ring if you want to keep the distance more or less constant. How these guys can tell each other apart is if you want to, okay, for this, I guess everybody knows that those like to form these Watson quick base pairs, which means A and T bind and G and C bind, and they do that by hydrogen bonds, which basically come from these three groups. Which bind to these three groups, and on the other side you have only two hydrogen bonds, and that's how they can tell each other apart, because some have three and some have two possibilities to form hydrogen bonds. Okay. Now what are the energy scales here? First of all, it's very important to note that although you like to think in terms of, aha, I have an AT pair here, that is a certain energy, and I have a GC here, that's a certain other energy. Actually, a single base pair is energetically very unfavorable, and the real strong interaction energy only comes from the base pair stacking. So if you have one base pair and you put another base pair on top, that is what gives you the major energy contribution. Now, how can you find out what these binding energies are? You can find out about it experimentally by one simple assumption. If you look at a piece of DNA like that, and here it is already appeared before several times, I mark the two ends of the DNA by the 5', by 5' and 3'. This has something to do with the fact that also the backbone has these rings. The carbon atoms are numbered in a certain way from one on, and the two atoms which are connected in the polymerization are the 3' and the 5'. So at one end you have a 5' atom hanging out, not being polymerized to the next sugar, and on the other end you have the 3' atom, carbon atom, which still could be polymerized to something else. So that's basically a convention to write the directionality of the strands. If you have a piece of DNA like that, a very short piece, you just assume that the binding energy of this whole thing is given as the sum of the binding energies of these stacks we have. So we have here first an AT and a TA stacked together, and we have two TAs stacked together, and as the next thing TAGC, and so on and so forth. What you do then is you do matching experiments. You cook up several sequences, short DNA sequences. You look where they melt, and you do that at different salt concentrations, and at the end, that will basically give you the free energy and the enthalpy at the melting point, and from that you backwards extrapolate to the temperature you're interested in. And the main groups who are doing that is the group by Santa Lucia, who does it for RNA, for DNA, and the group by Turner, who does the same thing for RNA. For RNA, I mean, RNA basically works the same way. I'll get back to that later. But you have different parameters. What you end up with is somehow it's not going to fit on here. Is a table like that. That means, for example, the energy of a stack like that, it is an AT stacked with a second AT. This would be this entry here. Then you have a TA stacked with an AT. This should be this entry here. This is a TA stacked with a CG. So I guess I'm wrong. It should be this one up here. And so on and so forth. You basically do the experiment for many combinations, and then you always assume that they add up like that, and then you deduce what the energy should be for every combination.
And you get consistent results.
Well, you get sort of consistent results. I mean, it practically seems to work, although they know that you can cook up oligomers which have the different sequences but the same local stackings, which do not have quite the same melting temperature, but they are not too different. So it is an approximation to do it that way, but it's sort of the standard approximation seems to work reasonably well.
Some simple argument why the stacking energy should vary like whatever is shown here.
Some simple, yes. Okay, but that, let me come to that. First of all, the most important number to keep in mind, these are energies in kcal per mole, and room temperature is about 0.6 kcal per mole. So you always can compare to that. Roughly speaking, you see that GC is about twice as strong as AT. Down here you have the pure AT, ATs, they are on the order of sort of KT. These are GCGC stackings here, they are on the order of 4KT, and then you have on the order of 2KT for the ATGC mixed stacks, and that is basically because you have these three hydrogen bonds in the GC and two hydrogen bonds in the AT.
That's why the AT stack and the TA is different from TA stacking and AT? Because they are really independent, then.
Okay. These two are identical, and those are not independent. And that is because this is palindromic. If you turn it around, it looks exactly the same way.
Yeah, but the TA and AT, or AT and TA, is there a difference there? Why those two numbers appear different? one is point negative 0.8 and one is negative 0.58.
Yeah, I mean, the Purin vacuum interactions are stronger than the Purin turinity because the ring is larger.
Yeah. So, I mean,
I think that it'd be only something like 10 in the 10 of parameters.
That is well possible. I mean, you have
more than
I mean, these two must be identical, these two must be identical, these two must be identical, and then there are also symmetries between these two corners. So you see these guys being identical, these guys being identical. I mean, there, yeah, I didn't count them actually, but I mean, there is a certain number, a certain symmetry in there.
The 10 is referring to the Poisson question. It's also included this.
I'm a little confused. What is it? CG, CG, and CG, GC in your table? What is the difference between the two? Huh? The two entries say CG, CG, that, yeah. CG, CG. The one, one, the thing of the matrix, and the CG, GC. The one, two element. Okay, one of them has both C's and one strands and both G's in the other strand. And the other one has one C and one G each in both strands. Okay?
So these terms must be looked as compared to that also one of the terms. The terms are which are horizontal K in the table.
Yes. Are they are vertical if you want to read it this way, exactly. So you are, so you, and that's another thing you note here. You do not only have GC, CG, GC, AT, and TA, but you also have GT and TG, because these are the so-called bubble-based pairs, which also can form sometimes, especially if you stack them with a GC, they actually are energetically favorable to form. So you have here all the six possibilities for one base pair, and down here all the six possibilities for the next base pair. And this table gives you the interaction energy of having a stacking from one base pair to the next.
One of the things I think of in proteins is this idea that hydrogen bonds really don't cause stability, increase stability, because of the fact that every hydrogen bond, intramolecular hydrogen bond you form, you break a corresponding intermolecular hydrogen bond and salvage whatever. That rule seems not to hold for RNA, for DNA and RNA. Why?
It does form. That's why it's stacking interactions, not base pair interactions.
But why is GC greater than strong than AT?
I mean, the story people tell you is that the hydrogen bonding helps align the bases so they stack better.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's what you mean by that.
Okay, so everybody roughly understands what this table stands for, and a way to remember it is sort of really, I mean, GC has the high energies and AT has the lower energies. In the first approximation, you can sort of count just the number of GCs, the number of ATs, but I mean, the reality is that it's more complicated. As we already discussed, these three energies are not symmetric because the strands are not symmetric. So this is, if we are at room temperature, and we actually have only those nice helices. However, these numbers which I showed you, they are not real pure binding energies. The way that you get them is by basically calculating the free energy difference between an RNA or DNA single strand, which is in solution, and this bound state. So they also contain an entropic contribution, and as a matter of fact, these entropic contributions are pretty large. So these free energies are actually differences between binding energies and entropic contributions, which are both on the order of 10 kT. But the differences are sort of only on the order of 2 kT. So what you can conclude from that, when you change temperature just a little bit away from 37 degrees, then the sign of these effective binding free energies would change, and that happens at around 80 degrees Celsius, and that's when your DNA or RNA will roughly in nature. What happens if you approach that is you suddenly get more complicated structures where you have stacks of base pairs, but then you get these sort of denaturation bubbles and again a stack of base pairs. Of course, you now would like to know what is the effective free energy of such a bubble, and you can already guess that it depends on a lot of factors. One of the most important things is, of course, the length of this loop. It also, and I'll comment on that a little later, it also depends in general on what the closing base pairs here are, and it also depends on what these dangling bases out here are. And people, of course, have been measuring these sort of loops as the free energy of these loops as well. And what you get, if you do that, if you forget the dependence on the individual bases here, you can just make a table for the free energy of such a loop as a number, as a function of the number of the opened base pairs here. And these numbers are again in kcal per mol. So you see that there's a very sizable contribution and very small openings. That is basically because the backbone has a bending rigidity, and it's very hard to actually make a loop which has only one open base. And then this falls down and it starts increasing again. Down here, I plotted this, and what you can see is that you can sort of reasonably well fit that with a function which is a constant plus 1.8 kT times the logarithm of this length. Well, where does this come from? Maybe go to this board here. This basically just comes from the fact that, okay, we have this last base pair here. Now we have this loop, we have another base pair, and we have this loop. And this loop has to, this piece of the single strand has to basically come back to this point again. So what you get is an entropic contribution to the free energy, which stems from the return probability of a single-stranded polymer, or for our purposes, of a random walk to the point where it can then close the loop. And obviously this is bound to each other, but the entropic contribution you get is level at the return probability of the random walk to this point here. Well, there is a return probability, if it were just a random walk, it would be, if this is in D dimension, D over 2, and, well, okay, so that the partition function would be L to the minus D over 2, and therefore the free energy which you would get is D over 2 times log L, which is 1.5 times log L. This 1.8 here is actually taking into account the fact that this should be a self-avoiding random walk. However, what it does not take into account is that there may be other of these bubbles around with which it also should self-avoid, but this is completely not in here, and I think you'll hear some talks on this subject tomorrow. The
L is total number of residues or residues on each side?
For these numbers, it's residues on each side. I mean, usually, yeah. I mean, you can also do it for asymmetric loops, and then you would give it here a number of total residues.
But
is it
a pair, base pair, or
no, for the whole thing?
For the whole thing?
For the whole thing. Base? Okay, there is no per base pair interaction. That is because you calculate all free energies relative to the completely unbound state. So the extensive part of the entropy is gone. It's zero, because, I mean, your reference state is the completely unbound state.
I see.
Okay, so we don't have an extensive part. That is included in these energy parameters. So all you see is the power law prefactor of the
free energy. But you think these numbers are very reliable? I mean, how do you actually get these numbers, and whether it's really that kind of number fit in this kind of formula?
Well, okay. What they actually do is, they cook pieces which cannot match here. So it forces a certain loop, and they again do the matching experiment, and then, I mean, once you derive what the parameters for all the stacks here should be, you can derive what the loop entropy for this length is. This 1.8 kT times log L actually kicks in only up here. So what they do is they use experimental values in a table like that for, if you want to really quantitatively describe denaturation, for example, up to here, and then for larger things you extrapolate it with this 1.8 kT log L.
This formula is valid when L is much larger than the persistence length, and you write with values which are much smaller.
Yeah, that's the persistence length of the
double strand.
Of the single strand. You're talking now about the return probabilities of single strand. So the persistence length of a single strand is on the order of three bases.
Three bases? Yes. Depends on the solve, I guess. Very much.
It's on the
solve.
Well, yeah. Okay, well, one thing to be said about this is all measured in one molar sodium. That's what that's what people usually use to measure these parameters. That's very high salt concentration. And that, I mean, yeah, the persistence length kicks in down here, because that's when you are in the order of the persistence length of your loop. But, I mean, up here, I think it's pretty safe to neglect that. What you also see here is this constant here is a relative large number, it's 3 kcal per mole, and this constant here obviously comes from whatever the length scale is in here, and what the fact reflects that it's so small is that these bonds are relatively well defined, so you have only a certain so this random walk has only a relatively small volume which it has to come back to, and how big this volume is, or basically how well defined the width of the bond is compared to the length of the bond, that is the ratio of that, the logarithm is this number. Okay. So that's if you know this table basically, and if you want to get more sophisticated, if you know also the corrections for which base pairs we have here and which standing ends we have, then in principle you can start to do quantitative description of denaturation. While there are even more interesting things you can look at. And then there's an important experimental technique in biology called DNA hybridization. What do you do in DNA hybridization? You start with two types of single-stranded DNA, and what you want to know is find out if they are similar or not. So you throw two pieces of single-stranded DNA into a test tube, for example, and then if they are similar enough, which means more or less complementary in this case, then they will of course be happy and form these double helical structures again. If they are too different, then they don't bind at all and stay away from each other. How do you know in which situation you are? Well, the simplest assay is that you can put some single-strand specific enzyme in there, which basically chews up all the single strand but can't do anything to the double strand, and then you see if you still have some DNA in there or not, and you know that it's not over here. An even more clever experiment is the following. You take one type of your DNA and you attach it to a surface so that it can't swim away, and at the end of the other DNA you put a marker, either a fluorescent or a radioactive marker molecule. And then obviously you can wash a solution with these green molecules with the markers over the plate where you fix those, and they will still be there if you wash with water afterwards, if they were bound, or they will have been washed away if they were not bound. You can do that not only with one type of DNA on a plate, but you can actually place on the order of 10,000 different of these lead molecules onto one plate, and this is what one calls a DNA array. So you can do experiments then where you take a solution of green guys, different green guys, you put different red guys down, you wash the solution over it. If the green guys are complementary to the red guys, they bind. If not, they are washed away. At the end, you measure where you have radioactivity or fluorescence, and you see which of the green molecules have been in the solution you started with. And that's something where I think a whole week of this workshop is devoted to.
You don't expect a lot of beta steady state?
What do you mean by...
Where the pieces which almost match with the... I mean, incomplete matching or...
Right, I mean, this is certainly of a very... If you do this sort of experiment, you try to tune your parameters like temperature and so on in a regime where it's really very hard to bind if you have this matching. But I mean, if you want to do similarity detection here, in that sort of experiment where you actually want things to bind which are not exactly complementary, then you would have to deal with the question, I mean, how to choose your parameters to still allow that. Now if you want to describe that, we already brought that up, but now we don't have exact complementary things anymore, so not everything has to match, so we can have, in addition to, of course, these denaturation loops, which are sort of symmetrical, you have things in one strand which don't fit to things in the other strand, you can also have things like that, barge loops, which have just in one strand something additional to what's complementary to the other strand. And, as you probably could have guessed, people measure the energetic parameters of those as well. The nice thing is you can think of this experiment as actually being an experimental realization of sequence alignment, where the binding free energies are your scoring matrix. So I mean, if you have a CG, then this scores high. If you have a T set, scores low. And if you have something which is not a Watson-Crick base pair at all, you get a negative score or a positive binding energy. And these loop free energies here correspond to the gap costs, which even have this feature of what we have learned about the fine gap costs, that putting a loop is very expensive. Making the loop longer is not that expensive anymore. So you can really think of that, well, at least the first approximation, this analogy, that all this molecule is really doing here is sequence alignment.
Only global sequence. But putting a gap might even gain energy by the entropy.
Yeah.
And you, why do you put very big loops?
Okay. If
because you're below the natural electron transition, maybe.
Right. I mean, it's not.
Depends on the temperature.
Okay. I mean, the one effect which I didn't talk about yet is that in these gaps, if you do them very long, the stuff which is in here will start to attract itself, and that's the definition. Then. I mean, then the analogy to sequence alignment starts breaking down very fast.
So when you do these experiments, if you were to look, are they, is there actually a double-stranded helix on these things? I mean, do they have
the... Right, whenever you have a long enough piece of complementary strands, you get a double-stranded helix, yeah. But nature is even fancier than that. There is a thing which you can do with two DNA molecules, which is the so-called holiday junction. Holiday junction is if you take two strands of DNA and you connect them in this way, and you can basically do that without disrupting any base pairings. And if you sort of, well, this is this double helical structure, if you sort of unwind this double helical structure, what you actually get is a configuration like this. Well, what does nature use that for? Nature uses that in order to get exchanges of homologous regions. So if you have, I mean, you have two sets of chromosomes and you want to mix and match pieces of them, then you can do the following. you can take the two, well, not quite identical, but homologous regions of the two identical chromosomes, you can make this sort of a crossing and reconnect the backbones in this way, that this backbone now goes here and this backbone goes here. And you haven't paid at least anything in terms of base pairings for that. Then this holiday junction can actually slide along the two DNAs without even breaking the backbone. So you just shift it over. That of course works only if these things are more or less completely homologous. And once you're here, you disentangle everything again, and the net effect of that is that these two pieces on one strand have been exchanged. So obviously people are interested in knowing what the energetics of such an object are, and in general you could have additional bases in here, you don't have to have everything bound. So the energetics will again depend on the number of open bases. Basically, you again will find a loop entropy with a logarithmic cost. It will depend again on the closing base pairs which you have in here. It will depend on dangling bases if you have unbound bases in the loop. And the energy of such a thing also depends on the number of helices you have in here. Well, here you have four, but you can easily imagine that you could also have structures of this type when you have like that five, six, or seven helices coming out, or only three.
In this, you're actually breaking, in order to do this crossover, you actually are breaking covalent bonds.
Right, you need serious help for that. Yeah.
Okay, so this.
But the moving here, that works without breaking. Okay, this brings us to DNA now, because into RNA. In DNA, the Faraday junction is already a very special thing, but in DNA, actually, these sort of loops where you have many stems coming out happen very frequently, all the time, actually. So what is the difference between DNA and RNA? First of all, we have, instead of the T, we have a U. These molecules basically just differ in this methyl group, so that's not really a very big difference. Another difference is that the backbone of the single-stranded RNA is a little more flexible. That doesn't really matter a whole lot either. The most important point about the difference between DNA and RNA is that RNA usually does not come with a complementary partner, whereas DNA does. So what does this poor RNA do? Well, since there's nobody else to bind to, it has to bind to itself. And then form these sort of structures. So you see here there's one single backbone going all the way around, and it forms these loops at the ends. And if you look very closely, you will find somewhere around here a structure which is actually the same thing as this holiday junction. It is four helical regions coming together and making basically a cross structure, and we'll see that two slides later, I think, a little better. So, we basically can first of all ignore these physical chemical differences and just say, well, the main difference between DNA and RNA for our purposes is that RNA is by itself and has to fold back into itself. But RNA, of course, is biological point of view, a very interesting molecule because it has two aspects. First of all, you already see when you look at that, this thing falls into a specific structure. So RNA is, in that sense, related to the proteins. They have a sequence. The sequence determines what quick base pairs you can form, and this will finally determine what structure this thing falls into, and this structure then can have some biological function. Typical example for that are the ribosomal RNAs and the transfer RNAs. And this here is, for example, transfer RNA. Those are used in basically translating from the nucleotide triplets in the genetic code into the amino acids.
So the persistent strength of double-stranded RNA, meaning when it's folded on itself, is much shorter than the persistence of
Yeah.
Well, when
it, yeah, well,
I mean, if you can't be measured at all, it's only closer to the
There's almost no configuration anymore.
That's a good question.
And one cannot bring it into a solvent condition such that it is, I mean, the secondary structure is there, but not the tertiary one.
Right, but I mean, what should the persistence length be? I mean, as long as you have secondary structure, you always have these loops, and these loops are floppy.
Yeah.
So, but...
Could you make double-stranded RNA?
Just make a long, exactly complementary double-stranded RNA. Okay. That's a good question. I wouldn't think that it's very different in persistence length. I don't know for sure. But I mean, yeah, in a real RNA, that basically never happens because you always have this floppy thing in between. Okay, then the other aspect, of course, is the information aspect. Well, this RNA, after all, has a sequence, and in that sense, it is very similar to the DNA. Most prominently, the messenger RNA, as you probably all heard in the first week, if you have the DNA, of your genome, if you want to make protein out of that, you first have to produce a messenger RNA, which is basically just a copy of the sequence of the DNA, and the main function of this object is to transport this information to the ribosome, in which it's then transformed into a protein sequence. Also,
is anything known about the structure of messenger RNA? Does it form these type of structures the same as transfer RNA, or is it floppy molecule?
That's
or
a very good question. I mean, it certainly will fold into something, because whenever you take some RNA, it will fold into something.
Uh-huh.
The question is if it's designed for something or not, and especially if it's designed for has something to do with splicing.
Uh-huh.
Or not, I think it's not really affirmatively known, but it's suspected.
So, I'll say there are all sorts of proteins all over most of the time, so it's not necessarily free to find.
That's true as well.
If one were to take the same, say, that RNA that you have the picture there, and do exactly the same sequence but with DNA, so with T instead of U,
yes.
That thing would not at all.
Yes. Well, I don't know if this will fall into the specific structure, but yeah, the next point here is if you have single-stranded DNA around, which usually in the biological conditions you don't, because there are proteins which protect single-stranded DNA, if you can create an experiment when you have single-stranded DNA, it will sort of form the same sort of structure.
Yes.
The energetic parameters are different a little bit. So I do not know if you take this sequence and you will do the same sequence of DNA if you will get this very same structure. Will you? No, I don't know. But I mean, you will get some structure.
But you will get
some. Yes. Okay, especially interesting, it then becomes if the structure and information aspects sort of interplay with each other. Richard already asked. One idea is that if you have splicing, that means we already heard about that again. Actually, if you have a gene in your DNA sequence, it contains these introns which do not code for the protein, so you first translate that into an RNA, then some mechanism has to cut out the introns out of the RNA and make a shorter RNA out of that. And so there is a possibility that actually the secondary structure of this thing helps bring these two pieces together. There are also things like the group 1 introns. Group 1 introns are pieces of RNA which basically can splice themselves out of an mRNA sequence. Or out of an RNA sequence. So this is an example of a more general class of RNA molecules, the so-called ribozymes, which through their structure and through their chemistry at an active site have a catalytic function, and of course, on the other hand, also contain the information of the sequence. And at least there's one theory, the theory of the RNA world, that before we had nowadays sort of division of labor between proteins, which carry structure, which are the structural elements of biology, and DNA, which is the information element of biology, that there was a situation that we had only RNA around, which did both. I mean, it contained sort of all the information which had to be replicated, plus it could fold up into the structural object which are needed to do this replication, and that from there on, then all this machinery evolved, which nowadays has DNA and protein, because as a matter of fact, DNA would not be able to replicate without protein, and we wouldn't have any protein without DNA, so we have to ask the question where did they come from. So there are obviously lots of interesting things happening around DNA. A nice feature, if you compare it to protein folding, for example, is that in RNA we have different energy scales which give us different structural levels much better defined than in proteins. Of course, the same thing as in protein, we have covalent bonds at a very high energy scale, and they define as the primary structure what one calls the primary structure, namely just the sequence of the RNA in which they molecules follow each other. Then we have this hydrogen bonding, which, as we've seen, happens on scales up to sort of 5 kT, and this is exactly this Watson-Crick base pairing, and this is something you can look at completely independently of what else happens to the molecule, and the set of which Watson-Crick base pairs are formed by a given sequence is called the secondary structure of the sequence, and this is an example of the sequence. It's the same thing as we already saw the transparency before, and so you see one which way around, so this is the beginning here, so you see the backbone goes around like that, and then you have these what's the Crick base pairs here. Then you have here the quadruple loop, sort of similar like this holiday junction but with unbound bases in there. You have these hairpin loops and so on and so forth. And if you would look at that then in three dimensions, obviously these pieces, these stems again form these helices as we are used to from DNA. On top of that we then have an interaction. Once base pairs are formed, they interact with each other and lead to a certain spatial arrangement which is called the tertiary structure. Large parts of the tertiary structure are actually mediated by divalent positive ions. That is basically the backbone is negative after all, so if you want to stick that stuff together, you better put some positive ions in there. So even if you may object that the energy scales for the tertiary interactions is not that much lower than for the secondary interactions, you can always get rid of the tertiary interactions if you just get rid of the magnesium.
How important are those exotic kind of like three-body hydrogen bonds in terms of tertiary structure? We have, you know, these long-distance guys coming in and forming these strange kind of combinations.
Well, they certainly happen, but the general idea is that they happen sort of on top of the secondary structure, so that they will form, but they will not disrupt what is already there in terms of secondary structure.
So this, how valid is this hierarchical thing? In other words, you ever have, for instance, a different secondary structure change because of tertiary interactions? Or is it
It happens, and that probably, and as if Hinoka will talk about that, I could imagine he does on Wednesday. But, I mean, in general, you sort of can turn this whole thing looking at only secondary structure into even some prediction tool, and those are not perfect, but they still do seem to predict the right things, although they do not take into account tertiary structure. I mean, it's certainly not right to say it never happens that tertiary structure disrupts secondary structure. But I mean, to first approximation, it seems to be justified to first study secondary structure and then look at tertiary structure on top of that. Okay. That's exactly what we will do now. before going there, just want to get some remarks on, obviously the question we would like to answer is what's the structure of a given sequence, and first of all, if we come up with a way to do that theoretically, how can we check that? And the different experimental methods are basically the two of them which are known for protein structure determination as well. It's X-ray crystallography, which in principle, of course, could give us tertiary structures. Unfortunately, it's extremely difficult, much more difficult than for DNA, for proteins, because this RNA is just flexible. For X-ray, you have to crystallize the stuff first, and that is very hard for DNA and for RNA. Other technique is NMR. It's also can, in principle, give you a tertiary structure, but it's also still relatively difficult. The most successful way.
What is the experimental difficulty
with NMR? Well, okay, not any more difficult than in proteins.
It's a lot harder, more of a fragile, isn't it? That you have to, the RNA is just a harder molecule to work with.
You mean in terms of keeping it in the solution?
Well, and fragility and things like that.
Well, I can see that being a problem for X-ray, but for NMR, I don't know.
So what is the limitation of NMR?
I don't know for sure, but I mean it.
Is somebody going to be talking about that later?
I don't know if anybody will be talking about NMR.
But it also seems the flexibility would be a problem for NMR as well.
So it's not going to give you static information, like a crystallography.
Right, but in RNA, it's an average confirmation of fluctuation. But if you have big fluctuations, then you're
viewing your
view, lose
your peaks. In other words,
you
still can't see disordered regions in NMR either.
Right, but I mean, you should at least, I mean, things which are bound to each other in the rank, you should see it. But the most successful method to do secondary structure prediction, at least, is the phylogenetic analysis. And that is very tricky. You take a lot of evolutionary related RNA sequences. So you look at the same RNA molecule in different species, and you watch for these things to happen. Where in one species you have an AU, somewhere an A and somewhere else a U in your sequence, and then suddenly in another sequence you have a G there and a C there. Joint mutation, but you never see an A and a C or a G and a U anywhere. So there's this, an almost sure sign that these two are bound in the structure, under the assumption that basically under evolution the structure is conserved, but the sequence is not necessarily conserved. Right? Of course this can give you only the secondary structure, but on the other hand this is an extremely reliable tool if you have enough sequences, and I mean for most of these ribosomal RNAs, for example, or tRNAs, you have like huge lists of sequences, and that's where most of these structures are known from. And on Monday afternoon, this will be precisely the subject of very strong.
The structure prediction is just important for the structural RNA, the tRNAs and RNAs. You wouldn't care about the mRNA, because that's the same approach, but it also be valid for any great pathogeny. Organic approach is still a plus protocol there.
I mean, with mRNA, of course, I have the problem that you have two different things. I mean, the protein involves where it codes for
Do they have tertiary structure ever?
Of mRNA?
If it can be shown that messenger RNA have definite three-dimensional structure, but tRNA hasn't been shown. For messenger RNA,
right,
has not been shown.
Yeah. But I mean, how do you know that it doesn't? I mean, it's
right. No experimental evidence, as far as they know. So the problem of determination on their tertiary structure maybe doesn't exist.
But here is only the secondary structure, it is a phylogenetic analysis, I think, right?
Yeah,
it's
a phylogenetic structure
for the...
This is applied, I don't know for tRNA and ribosomal RNA.
Yeah.
I don't know for messenger RNA.
But you think
although there are some elements, sometimes the messenger RNA will prevent them from translation.
But even if there is a structure for mRNA, it still might not work, only if there is some type of selective pressure for the structure being conserved.
Yes. And stable, and so on.
Question, question. I think of this sort of the theoretical work in terms of RNA evolution versus protein evolution. It seems like that RNA, this ability of it to change structure with substitutions, is a lot larger. What is so this idea that evolutionarily related RNA has the same structure, how valid is that? I mean, if you look at evolutionarily related RNA sequences, that really have the same structure?
Well, at least for the ribosomal RNAs, that's certainly true.
The ribosomal RNAs, what about the tRNAs?
The tRNAs are basically the same sort of structure. They all have this cross shape. And they are sort of not so interesting because they are so short. I mean, for tRNAs, you can even basically get a theoretical tool. Just for matching things up. There are not so many possibilities to match things up in the right way but on a matching basis.
So in terms of structure being important in RNA, it just is tRNA, 20 of them.
Well, right, ribosomal RNA.
So they are a very countable number.
Yeah, there are these group 1 introns. Yeah, it's basically true.
How many are they? 100?
Not less.
Definitely less than the protein world.
Yes. I mean, the ones which are really studied are the group 1 introns, the ribosomal RNAs and the tRNAs. If you look at databases of RNA structure, that's basically what you find in there.
Can you just explain why it's important for tRNA and mRNA? Mm-hmm. Why is the structure, I didn't understand, why was the structure only important for certain RNAs?
Well, it depends on what their function is. For example, mRNA has basically mainly the function to transport information from the DNA to the ribosome. So it's not a priori clear that the secondary structure needs something. Now, as far as I know, it could happen if this thing folds up in the wrong way that it won't work anymore. In that sense, it is important. But I don't think that anybody has really experimentally proven that. I mean, there must be a certain structure to messenger RNA to work. Whereas tRNA and ribosomal RNA, I mean, they really work like proteins in a sense, right? They fall into a certain shape, and this shape has to fit together with the proteins in the ribosome in the right way in order to get this whole machinery going. I think there's glycosome there, some RNAs in there as well, which are also structural. But yeah, it's not a whole bunch of different RNAs. Structure.
How long is the mutation carriers always part of what is the average distance separating the second step? It's fairly close.
Now you're basically asking a typical RNA structure, how far apart are things? And I mean, yeah, there is certainly a decay as a function of the distance. This doesn't have anything to do with evolution, that's just what is the structure, which you see there. And yeah, the larger, I mean, this is the less often you see them. Most frequently you have these helices, like. I mean, that's the most typical case where you sort of have things very close together in the line. But, yeah.
Is the substitution rate for these RNAs much smaller than proteins? Because it seems with proteins, you can change one amino acid and the protein adjusts, and maybe it's okay, and then you make another one and it's back to happy again. But this one, it would seem that if you make one mismatch in the bound region, that would be extremely unfavorable, which means either you have to have a double mutation on two separate parts of the strand, or this thing has to be just survive in an unhappy state long enough to get a second compensatory mutation. So it would seem that would be much slower than
I mean, if you disrupt one base, what usually happens is that the things will not fold into anything close to what it was before. If you do not do a compensatory mutation.
There's also much more proofreading of transcription than of translation.
There's
more proofreading of transcription than of translation. Than you'd expect mutation rate.
One thing ever changes at the DNA level.
He thinks about accepting mutations.
Yeah.
Basically. And because you only accept if you have three compensatory. I don't know. Yeah. Probably, yeah, we'll think.
in protein folding, people do NMR, and what they do is they measure nearby pairs of hydrogens. And that's usually enough to reconstruct, sometimes it's enough to reconstruct the 3D structure of the protein. Now for the case of RNA, you can almost know computationally the secondary structure, so one would think that this is really a lot of information that it kills. The phase space of search for the three-dimensional structure would be much smaller. Isn't that, because you essentially you know all the base pairings, so it's like a lot of NMR measurements, and you know. So
I mean, I'm sure they take it into account.
If I may add a little word on this, I think the problem with RNA structure by NMR is that you have very long sequences to get a compact 3D structure. So if you want to use NMR to solve the structure, as you say, you have to have a set of long-range interactions. But what happens with sequences that are accessible to chemical synthesis, like around 100 nucleotides, is that you have very often two very long